Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Knife. This is Patrick Georgioff. I want you to imagine this. It's 2 a.m. and you're rushing a hypotensive trauma patient to the operating room for exploration. Maybe you need to go into the neck, the chest, or the abdomen. Are you prepared for what you might find? Trauma educational resources are extremely limited, and that's why we created the Trauma Surgery Video Atlas. 24 challenging scenarios with high-yield text, beautiful illustrations, and stunning professional-grade video that walks you through the approach and management of devastating injuries in a step-by-step fashion. Check out the link in the show notes for more. There are group discounts available as well. Now, enjoy the episode and dominate the day.
Welcome to Behind the Knife with the Emergency General Surgery team at the University of Missouri School of Medicine. This is our inaugural episode at Mizzou, and we're excited to join the team at Behind the Knife to provide educational content in emergency general surgery. I'm Rushabh Dev, and today we're bringing back an essential skill that's fading from our collective memory, open cholecystectomy. This episode is about getting back to the basics and walking through the key steps of open cholecystectomy, including how and when to perform them safely. So let's meet our team.
Hey, y'all. My name's Jeff Kokenauer. I'm one of the acute care surgeons and the trauma medical director at the Mitchell Trauma Center here in Mizzou.
I'm Dr. Chris Nelson. I'm another acute care surgeon here in Mizzou. I'm the medical director of emergency general surgery also.
And I'm Mike Anchetta. I'm currently finishing my second year of fellowship for the ACS fellowship here at Mizzou.
And my name's Desiree. I'm currently a third year in general surgery here at Mizzou, and I'm interested in pursuing acute care.
So guys, what do we all know other than I have an international and national hatred for all gallbags? Well, cholecystectomy is one of the most performed operations in the United States. We know that about 1.2 million cases are documented every year, and as far as we do know, through most recent inpatient records, about 6-7% of complications still occur annually.
That's right, and don't forget the feared complication of bile duct injury that remains at 3-4 out of 1,000 operations a year, even for the most experienced surgeons.
Yeah, for acute care surgeons, man, I sometimes feel like every severely inflamed gallbag is just a grenade with a pin waiting to be pulled. Severe complications from bile duct injuries are life-threatening, but also kind of altering for a surgeon's career. I want to take this point to remind everyone about episode 534 on the difficult gallbladder. It's an excellent resource when approaching the core fundamentals of the specific disease process. Hey, Dr. Fletcher. Can you give us a brief review of how we define or grade cholecystitis when considering surgical approaches?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I'm sure y'all are all aware, there's several grading systems out there to characterize the severity of cholecystitis, either pre-op or intra-op. So most cited systems that are well known include the Tokyo Guidelines, the Parkland Grading Scale, and the American Association of Surgery for Trauma. All of these are validated with a good degree of accuracy. Notably, the Parkland scale has been shown to be most accurate in predicting conversion to open or the use of some other bailout techniques such as subtotal cholecystectomy. Recently, the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery referenced independent studies selecting risk factors that are associated with the difficulty of each cholecystectomy. Some of these include male sex, an elderly patient, a higher ASA score, Charleston comorbid index greater than 6, multiple abdominal surgeries, diabetes, prior sphincterotomy, and a delayed cholecystectomy greater than 2 weeks from presentation. The more risk factors in each patient obviously increases the likelihood of conversion and then a difficult dissection.
Yeah. So, Dr. Anchetta, do you think you can tell us a little bit about what programs are out there to help guide surgeons when potentially approaching a difficult gallbladder?
Yeah, of course. So in 2018, the Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons, aka SAGES, published consensus recommendations known as the Safe Cholecystectomy Program. They outlined 6 strategies to help minimize the incidence of bile duct injuries. 1, use a critical view safety method of identification of the cystic duct and cystic artery during laparoscopic cholecystectomy. 2, understand the potential for aberrant anatomy in all cases. And to that degree, I'd also add in, make sure you look at all pre-op imaging. Know if you have aberrant or variations in your vasculature as well. 3, make liberal use of cholangiography or other methods to image the biliary tree intraoperatively. 4, consider an intraoperative momentary pause during laparoscopic cholecystectomy prior to clipping, cutting, transecting any ductal structures. Number 5, recognize when the dissection is approaching a zone of significant risk and halt the dissection before entering that zone. Finish the operation by a safe method other than cholecystectomy if conditions around the gallbladder are too dangerous. And number 6, Dr. Dev's favorite, get help from another surgeon when the dissection or conditions are difficult.
Great, great, great. I'm glad the humor is about to pick up. So let's unpack number 1 and 2 just a little bit more and provide some clarity on some of those key terms. So first, Desra, can you define the critical view of safety for us?
Yeah, sure. So the critical view of safety is clearly defined by 3 important points. This should be visualized both anterior and posterior. So first, the hepatocystic triangle is cleared of all fatty tissue. The triangle is defined by the anatomic boundaries of the cystic duct, the common hepatic duct, and the inferior edge of the liver. It's where it interfaces with the neck of the bag. The second point is that the lower third of the gallbladder is free from the liver to expose the cystic plate. And then finally, 2 and only 2 structures are seen entering the gallbladder.
Sweet. So, hey, Micah, recognizing the zone of increased risk where further dissection could potentially lead to more injury is paramount, right? So why don't you define for us some of the options available when this point of the operation is reached?
Yeah. I also think this is a great segue into the meat of our discussion and how conversion to an open procedure can be part of that safe pathway. It's important to understand that approximately 10 to 15% of cases with severe inflammation will prohibit dissection of the critical value of safety as previously described.
Yeah, man. Did you know that inflammatory wall of tissue over the hepatocystic plate is called McElmoy's shield? It's kind of stupid, but I kind of moved to call it barrier to happiness.
Piggybacking off of that statement, Safe Cholecystectomy Program highlights a brief pause. In fact, in a What You Need to Know series in the Journal of Trauma this past year, they highlighted a straightforward algorithm to follow. So 1, take a timeout. This is like a halftime timeout in the middle of your operation. Number 2, employ the mnemonic Be Safe, S-A-F-E, and reorient yourself as 95% of bile duct injuries are due to spatial disorientation. That breaks down B, visualize the bile duct at the duodenum or the hilum, either way that you can find it. S, visualize the sulcus of Ruvier. A, make sure the hepatic artery is to the left of the porta hepatis. F, the umbilical fissure is to the left. And then E, enteric stomach or duodenum to orientate yourself vertically, or correct your medical student or intern who's holding the camera. 3, ensure proper retraction. 4, call for a second opinion. Get a senior surgeon in the room to kind of help you identify what you need to see. And then 5, consider intraoperative imaging. If you can't safely achieve a critical view at this point, you need to start considering what your bailout options and strategies are, or convert to an open procedure.
Yeah. Unpack that for us a little bit. So what are those bailout strategies?
So the two most common procedures described are called a fenestrating and a reconstituting subtotal cholecystectomy. Dr. Strasberg defined both procedures as excising the free peritonealized portions of the gallbladder. The difference is the technique at the lowest portion of the gallbladder, for which part for us is called infundibulum. In the fenestrated procedure, a lip is created at the lowest part and the posterior wall of the gallbladder is left in situ. Some surgeons attempt to suture the cystic duct closed from the inside. However, this maneuver can be difficult, especially laparoscopically. The reconstituting technique involves closing the gallbladder remnant at the lip with a suture or a stapler, reconstituting, quote unquote, an intact lumen.
Yeah, so much like a lot of things in medicine, old becomes new and new becomes old. This procedure has gained a lot of popularity in recent years, but we forget that it was originally described in 1955. Like every decision we make, even if it's safe, it's not without risk. Most of the literature studying these procedures are retrospective and small, and we do know that the fenestrated technique is associated with a 35% bile leak rate and the need for ERCP in about 44% of all cases. Additionally, reoperative rates approach 5% versus 3% for subtotal versus open cholecystectomy, respectively. Not to mention that the reconstituting technique creates a neo-gallbladder, increasing the risk of recurrent gallstone disease. Almost 3% of patients receiving a subtotal cholecystectomy require completion cholecystectomies.
Yeah, but in those systematic reviews, wasn't bile duct injuries less in the subtotal group as compared to the open cholecystectomy?
Yes, by numbers it was, but only by 0.9%. And when compared to bile leaks, need for ERCP, reoperations, and overall need for percutaneous drainage, open cholecystectomy outperforms subtotal procedures.
Yeah, so with that, why don't we get into the details of approaching an open gallbladder? Hey, Dr. Kokonauer, so why don't you kick us off, yeah? Let's pretend it's next week, which it is going to be next week, on a typical day in EGS with Dev in the OR taking a 65-year-old male with a one-week history of abdominal pain, a BMI of 40, and a past surgical history of a laparotomy for a sigmoid colectomy who has what looks like clinical and radiographic evidence of a AAST grade 3 cholecystitis. So about an hour into the case, as you expected, a call from the OR comes out to you in routine fashion, and unbeknownst to me, you had already cleared your day, and you know you're about to be called into the OR to help out.
I'm available too.
Yeah, whatever, you suck. At some point, I'm going to have a PSA about bullies in academic medicine. But anyway, so Kokonauer, you walk into the OR and you find Dev yelling some choice but professional words while the OR lights are being turned on and he's making an incision in the right upper abdomen. So what's the first thing to keep in mind when planning an open cholecystectomy?
So I think I'll start with before we dig into the technique, I think a lot of people will eventually realize that they're in trouble. They'll call for help and we kind of go down the pathway we're getting ready to describe. I think I'll make the point that the other important factor is even if you're not in trouble, somebody has got to recognize when you're not making progress. So if the case is not moving along, there's a lot of time-wasting maneuvers, trying to, you know, bovey through rind, just going up one side or the other, but there's really no focus on identifying the cystic duct or the cystic artery, and you've been at it for a while, then maybe it is time to consider conversion to an open procedure. And I'm going to jump on board with what Dr. Nelson had said earlier, that the description of subtotal or reconstituting certainly exists, and there's been a lot of people discussing or writing about that and drainage. But I think we would agree that it's just not a great option. You really have to consider, A, what you're doing to the patient and the risk that they're going to have additional problems, and B, who are you actually kicking the can down the road for? And I think often it's one of your own partners or somebody else in your institution who's going to have to come and mop up this issue down the road. Because the cholecystitis ain't just magically going to go away and the procedure becomes easy in a few weeks. I think those are important points.
Yeah, those are salient. I always forget about that. You know, like one of my first cases here is remembering late in the afternoon having one of you guys come up after about 2.5 hours into a bad gallbladder and I got that face through the window and I think the statement was, so are you going to make a decision to go open or not? We want to go home. So
I think you also have to think about too, you know, the patients that we're operating on that are to the point where they have a difficult gallbladder. We do these bailout procedures, how do they fail? And what complications are we reintroducing into that system? And are they going to be able to tolerate that from a physiologic standpoint? Is also another consideration you need to have.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we're going to start the open procedure, I think we all agree that we're going to do the right subcostal incision. The first element that I would touch on is probably one of the things that might be least appreciated in residency. You know, it's not until you're out on your own that you recognize how a simple retractor application and getting good visualization of what you need to do was maybe something done by the faculty. And now when you're charged with doing it on your own, it's a whole new ballgame. Whether or not you use the oval, which probably a lot of us would do, you pull out the circle for a Buchwalter. Some of you out there might be fans of an Omni. I don't think it matters. I think what matters for me is probably a medium length right angle under the ribs so that you're able to pull the right costal margin up. Usually some combination of a wider malleable inferiorly to pull the colon and some of that associated omentum down out of your way. And then often something medially to kind of pull the stomach and to put some medial retraction on the duodenum so that you have a pretty good exposure. And ideally the gallbladder is in the middle of your field. I think you're going to elevate the head of the OR bed to some degree to kind of help that stuff drop down. And then my only caution is there's too much of a good thing. There's too many retractor blades that then create, you know, this field like you're operating down at the bottom of a mason jar, right? And I don't think that's obviously no good. So there's just a fine line between good exposure and then too much stuff that gets in your way. So
So I'm going to back up one step before putting your retractor in and just ask Desiree where that proper incision should be for your subtotal or your subcostal incision.
2 finger breadths below the right costal margin.
Right. And I really want to emphasize the importance of taking your time making this initial incision. Number one, identifying both the anterior and posterior fascia. And number two, taking your time dividing the abdominal wall musculature. Take your time with cautery, number one, so it doesn't bleed throughout the case. And you come back and remove the retractors at closing time and find a bunch of blood behind them and a bunch of bleeding you have to deal with later. But number two, the more time you take making good, clean incisions in those fascia, it's going to pay dividends for you when it comes time to closing that fascia in 2 layers, being able to reapproximate that nicely.
So let's see, we've got incision, we've got retractors in. If we're going to now move towards taking everything down, I think most of the time you can separate the surrounding inflammatory rind, whether that's with your finger, whether that's with maybe one of the more firm plastic Yankauer suction devices. I think whatever you choose to use, you can start to sort of peel things off. There's almost always a very nice plane around the inflammatory rind of the gallbladder. I think then the next question sort of becomes, how do you optimize retraction? You can chop a hole in the dome of the gallbladder. You could suck it out. We're going to almost always start with a dome down fashion, but how do you best get either an allus or a Coker on the dome so that you can begin to manipulate the top of the gallbladder left and right? And then once you get that figured out, cautery, not just 30-30, but set up to stun so that you can really start to burn the gallbladder away from the liver edge and start working your way down towards the infundibulum.
Yeah, I think that was actually a really good point watching you come in and help me out on almost every gallbladder that I've done open, but going up on the cautery to, 60-60 and something with a little bit more thermal kick really helps as you're getting through that rind and also getting hemostasis. So your field is essentially staying relatively dry so you can stay in a good plane and not get off. So I think that was a really good salient point I learned early on.
I think a lot of us don't burn. You don't burn in a straight line. I mean, you recognize that you're going to kind of use that cautery to both divide the tissue and all those small vessels that are back there in that inflammation, but you're also going to use it to push the tissue apart as you start to go. And assuming you can find a good plane between the gallbladder or the rind and the liver bed, that's what you're going to use. But if you can't, then maybe that's when we talk about leaving some of the back wall in place as you start to work your way down.
Yeah, that was a big learning point for me. I think it's tempting to go in the wrong plane because, you think you're making progress. But any injury to those superficial hepatic branches off, whether that's the middle hepatic vein or those intrahepatic ductules, it not only risks significant blood loss, but it also risks postoperative bowelma.
Right. And you have to re-enter a more superficial plane halfway down anyways, especially as you approach the infundibulum. Just like laparoscopic surgery, maintaining constant tension and countertension is paramount, keeping in line with the principles of general surgery. What I've also found, though, is if you can develop that plane between the rind and the gallbladder wall proper, get an allus clamp on that or a ring forceps, that will allow you to get that tension between those two planes that you're trying to separate that might allow for an easier blunt dissection.
I think in a global picture, it's important to remember what you're trying to accomplish. Just like in traumas, we're trying to medialize every organ system to try to remove it. We're basically trying to do the same thing with the gallbladder. We're trying to remove the adhesions and bring it out into our incision to make it easier for us to manipulate. So as we dissect down through the planes, we're trying to elevate that out of the liver bed into our incision and isolate that down to a single structure. As we've already talked about various methods of getting into that appropriate plane, I think finding that gallbladder wall, much like just reversing it when you're doing a laparoscopic procedure, when you get through that rind and you're doing it from a critical view of safety up technique, now you're doing a dome down technique, getting through that rind and just finding the gallbladder wall and finding that plane. Never forget your finger is the best dissector you have, right? And you may cause some bleeding back towards the liver, but that's usually superficial bleeding. You're not lacerating the hepatic artery. It's really hard to hurt things with your finger. Not impossible, but it's difficult.
I think you have to be very willing to be mobile. You know, you don't just, if something's not really very forgiving on one particular place, you know, be willing to move around. But don't forget probably the typical aspects that you would employ when you're laparoscopic, that things don't live laterally, right? So you can have a little bit more latitude, a little bit more freedom to find that plane that Dr. Nelson's talking about laterally first, and then keep working your way more medial, more lower, more medial. And eventually you should come to more of a, you know, the funnel of the infundibulum. And I think it's almost a toss up too. When a lot of these cases, the lower you go, the easier it'll get. You know, the dome is the part that's really nasty, but you know, certainly that's not a rule all the time. Sometimes that bottom part's tough, or the toughest.
So I want to ask you guys, because I've seen this a couple times since I've been here. We've developed that plane. We've gotten most of the dome of the gallbladder down. What are the tools? What are the instruments? What are the techniques that you're using down there at the infundibulum to help you identify those structures?
Yeah, like more importantly, you know, when you get to that inflammation that gets you to stop in a laparoscopic case where you're over a Collatz triangle or the shield of McElroy or whatever, you know, the shield of happiness. When you get to that point in an open procedure, what do you guys use instrument-wise and kind of your retraction and countertension to help provide that dissection, or to help you continue that dissection safely?
So as we talked about earlier, I think tension and countertension is your best friend, especially as you get down there, pulling it off the porta patis. I'll many times have either, you know, up to three Alice's or three Babcocks in my hand on different portions of the gallbladder itself, providing different areas of traction. And it's really going to depend on the type of inflammation you have, right? Is it that acute inflammatory tissue from acute infection, or is it that acute on chronic stuff, that stuff that's been there for years? You're going to handle each of them different. The acute stuff is going to be more friendly to you. You're going to be able to break away with your finger or right angle through, or use a bridge and cauterize through. That chronic stuff, I find peeling is a great technique, whether you're using Kittner, whether you're using the back end of a right angle and just not trying to burn through it, but just peeling it away by using the elbow of the right angle, just opening it up and peeling it down as you continue to try to make progress.
I think the point I would make too at this point in the case is that it's going to bleed, right? And maybe this only comes with timing or experience, but expect there to be a bit of a bloody field. Now, I know we're not talking about significant pulsatile surgical bleeding, but there's going to be clot. It's going to be messy. And you just have to have some confidence that as you get down to the bottom, you know, you're getting close, as you get down and as you get the cystic duct controlled and divided, maybe or maybe not, you find a cystic artery more medially. Sometimes it's obliterated in these chronic conditions, but as you get down there and the thing comes out, gosh, it dries up, right? So just don't let that scare you off that you're in the wrong place necessarily.
So yeah, that kind of reminds me of the last couple of cases I did open where I was dealing with that acute kind of chronic inflammation and got down to the infundibulum and couldn't progress. And you came in and you helped me kind of decide to open up the gallbladder there and essentially proceed from inside out. Can you help unpack that a little bit, or what kind of pearls of wisdom you have on that maneuver?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few options. If the rind is forgiving enough and you can finger fracture your way, then sometimes the very last part of that you can palpate where the infundibulum will transition into the cystic duct. If you're lucky enough to have a big stone impacted in the bottom of the gallbladder, that makes it very obvious where the bottom is. If you can't really feel very well, then just open the thing some more, right? And either visualize where the infundibulum is from the inside, or you know, you just put your finger down in there and you'll feel where the bottom of that funnel is. And now the only question is, how do you finish the last bit of dissection medially, knowing that you're keeping an eye out for a possible cystic artery? But you're almost there. Whether you control it with a right angle, whether you get a tie around there, whether you just, you know that you're down to that level, do you just lop it off and then over-sew if you can't clearly dissect your cystic duct? I think those are sort of game time options. The only caution here, though, is you're at some point in time, and was the case in my common duct injuries, you will sometimes have that common duct stuck up to that chronic inflammation. And you think you're coming down along the bottom part of the infundibulum in the bag. And every once in a while, that's the more anterior wall of the common bile duct. So there is, although we're talking about it like, hey, you're almost home free, you do still have to always maintain this high index of suspicion when the inflammation is all the way down on the porta.
Remember, your goal is to get down to one or two structures. And I emphasize one more than two, because a lot of times you're going through the cystic artery, or you obliterate the cystic artery in your dissection, you've never even seen it. A lot of times it's already been, you know, clotted off the secondary to the inflammation, which is why your gallbladder is already dead and you're taking it out. So a lot of times you never even see it. So you're really only going down to one structure. And, you know, don't forget your use of adjuncts, especially down in this area, right? Can you shoot a cholangiogram? Right? Do you have that ability? Do you have ICG available to you to use to help you delineate the anatomy? It's better to try to attempt to delineate the anatomy before you start chopping across structures you're not sure of. It'll keep you out of trouble later.
Those are pretty good salient points. I always forget about, you know, even considering just putting a cholangiocatheter through that cystic duct to see if there's any concern or question. And if it's obliterated, it's obliterated. Your job's done, right? Do you guys leave drains at all at the end of your procedures when there's any concern?
I think if I know that we've secured the cystic duct, no, because the bleeding's going to stop. We're going to irrigate the field and there's no need for a drain. I think if you've just come across it and it's wide open, or you just can't even find it because it's so obliterated, then probably so.
Yeah, so if I've got good purchase of tissue, I've got a good ligation around it, I've got a good clip across it, depending on what I'm able to do in the field, then I agree, no drain needed. Now, if the patient had a big abscess cavity that I've also drained, I may leave one just for infectious drainage for a day or two. But if I'm confident in my ligation technique and I've identified the cystic duct that I'm sure of, I won't leave it for a bile leak.
All right, guys. So as we're getting through the critical aspect of the case and the dissection, and we're close to the finish line, Micah, you know, you're about to graduate and go out and be an attending on your own, start your career. Is there anything salient, or is there anything important that you think you'd want to know specifically as a pearl from not so much the elder population, but maybe the wiser surgeons in the room that have done this procedure?
Yeah, I think thinking if we're at this point in the case, you know, we've gotten the structures safely dissected free, because that's the whole point of this, is not to get through it quickly, but to get through it safely. What is your decision making? What is your thought process when ligating these structures? Do you use silk? Do you use PDS? Do you use endoloop? Do you use clips? Do you use staples? What is your thought process and what do you use and why?
Most straightforward, right angle, and then a 2 or 3-0 silk around the end of the right angle. Just a good old fashioned ligation.
So I was taught in residency to suture ligate with a PDS. We always use a PDS in my training. However, I've gone to what Dr. Kokenauer does too, just a suture around a right angle if your anatomy agrees with that. As Desiree remembers last week, you know, we did the 250-kilogram open gallbladder, and kind of like Dr. Kokenauer talked about his mason jar, we were working in a silo and we attempted to do a suture around a right angle, but it was so deep and so thin that we were working the glass dome or glass silo we were working was too thin to get a hand down there. So we chose an automatic clip applier and got good clips around the tissue deep in this hole that we were working in. So I think what the anatomy and what the patient's tissue quality plays a role in it. But yeah, I think just a suture around a good clamp is the go-to option.
And ideally, you know, we've talked about these couple ways to secure that, but there's going to be the times where you've done a safe dissection, but there's still no good tissue, no good quality tissue left down there. I would argue always better to just lay a drain behind. Maybe or maybe not going to have to engage your GI colleagues for a stenting at some point. The last thing you want to do is try to push a suture ligation, especially when you're just not sure where things are living deeper down, right? That's when you're gonna inadvertently injure something. Just let it get drained and let it get dealt with another day. You've done the operation, don't make things worse.
Yeah, stay out of tiger country. And that's when
sure.
Yeah, that's when you leave that drain. And from my understanding, a lot of these, you know, post-op bile leaks when the cystic duct may or may not be actually partially open from inflammation or not, they tend to resolve on their own, even without a common bile duct stent. So it's just something to watch. And it's better to, you know, to have that than to get into any more trouble.
Always choose the operation that will fail well. So if it's just leaving a drain and potentially having to do something, but I agree, most of the time, they're going to do fine.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we get to the end of the operation, just to reiterate one of Dr. Nelson's biggest points is when we're done and we're on our way out, remember, be safe and finish the case and do everything appropriately. And remember, when you're closing the fascia, there's two layers, right? There's an anterior fascia and a posterior fascia, two components that you should always close in two separate stitches that are running, typically with a slowly absorbing stitch, right? So don't get too hastened just to get out of the OR. Do it right so the patient has a good outcome. So let's go ahead and just wrap things up now, right? So Desra, why don't you give us a couple of quick hits now that we've finished up such a big topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So keeping in mind SAGE's six steps in the safe cholecystectomy program. Number one, use the critical view of safety. This method identifies both the cystic duct and the cystic artery during a lap chole. Number two is understanding the potential for aberrant anatomy in every case that you do. Number three, make liberal use of cholangiography or any other methods to image the biliary tree intraoperatively. Fourth, consider an intraoperative momentary pause that we mentioned earlier in the podcast during a lap chole just prior to clipping, cutting, or transecting any ductal structures. Number five, recognize when the dissection is approaching a zone of significant risk and stop before entering the zone. You want to finish the operation by a safe method other than a cholecystectomy if any conditions around the gallbladder are too dangerous. And then finally, and probably most importantly, get help from another surgeon when the dissection or conditions are difficult.
That's my favorite.
The Tramiel is often used.
Yeah, shut up. Finish us up.
We know. Also, know your landmarks and anatomy, including vascular variants. Remember, spatial disorientation leads to high rates of bile duct injury. Remember the mnemonic, be safe.
So take your time. A good, well-fashioned subcostal incision that then has a retractor system of your choice that either has or very soon will have the gallbladder right in the middle of your operative field.
Converting to open is not failure, okay? It may take some more time. As long as you're making progress, you can still perform the right operation for the patient and remove their disease process, even though they have a longer incision.
Maximally invasive surgery.
Amen.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. Open cholecystectomy isn't just an option. It's a vital skill, so don't let it become a lost start. From all of us here at Mizzou, until next time, keep learning and stay sharp.
Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.